Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I did promise in the blurb that today I was going to explain why I started calling this the Talky Bit. And my guess would be that you have not wondered about that because it's so darn obvious. It's someone at the front talking for, 30 minutes. It's a bit of talking, hence, Talky Bit. And yes, I am aware that some of you call it the Timbit. There's now an official graphic. I think this is what happens when you give AI a prompt and just turn it loose. I think that this would be called the Timbit is genuinely funny. And also, given how delightful Timbits can be to consume, I could potentially see it as a compliment. When I reflected on that a little bit, though, I was also like, also, those things will kill you. Like, if that's your whole diet, they're not good for you at all. So I'm still assessing that whole, is it a compliment part. But here's the below the waterline reason why I call these explorations Talky Bits. And this is not arbitrary. This is not just like, say something funny at the beginning of your talk. It warms up the crowd. It's got some substance for me. I started calling these the Talky Bit because I wanted to do something, as much as it was up to me, I wanted to do something systemic. I wanted to do something structural, something with language and consistency to displace this notion that whoever is at the front of the room is speaking from a place of unique authority. Unique opportunity? Absolutely. Unique responsibility and trust? Yes. Some sort of uniquely disproportionate or ultimate authority? No. And for some of us, an idea like that will immediately make sense. Of course the person at the front of the room is on the same level as everyone else in the room. They're a human being, and all human beings have equal value. So why would this situation be the exception? Indeed. Why would it be the exception? Why in so many settings? In this hour of this day, in this time zone, is this being treated as the exception? For others of us, maybe those of us who grew up around religious expressions or other systems that treated leaders as authority figures, perhaps even spokesmen, and yes, I chose men on purpose, for the divine, that idea might not feel as accessible. I don't think of the role that I fill in this community as ecclesiastical. I don't think of it as part of any religious structure or hierarchy. There's no sort of religious denominational org chart indicating the authority level of the role's occupant. I think there's a whole additional conversation, we're not going to have it now, but about the difference between authority and influence. I think that's a potentially much more productive way to think about healthy life and community. One of the things I enjoy about this community, for example, is the way we just spent the last part of our time together, where any of us have the opportunity to share something that we're reflecting on, something that matters to us, something about which we have an idea or an experience to share. And everyone in the room has the opportunity to be influenced by that. That's better. What I do feel, personally and positionally, is that I'm regularly extended an extraordinary amount of trust, and I'm given this incredible opportunity to support or initiate the exploration of belief for anyone who wants to do that in the context of this community. Or anywhere, really, but this is our moment together. And as many of you have heard me say, my deepest feeling about my role in this community is one of wonder and privilege. It really is this. It's not like there's nothing ever onerous about it. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna-ish about this. There are bits of it that are, you know, doing the chores, right? But on the whole, my sense about this is just this deep, abiding theme of who gets to do this. How marvelous. and that really hasn't gone away. And I mention that because, as we will see, it's in stark contrast to some other pretty potent possibilities. It's not the only way for a community to function. It's not a given. In fact, it is not the way most religious communities are structured. Which, to be clear, and I wish to be abundantly clear about this, does not mean that this one is good and the others are bad. That is not the point. We'll add some nuance in that regard as we go. For now, what I want to emphasize is that this part of how we function, my hope is that this part of how we function can provide a kind of a canvas on which some contrasting approaches can be illustrated in ways that might help us all understand how some structures, and I think it's important to regard the structures as distinct from those who execute the structures, because some of this is just flat-out structural, that some structures are more likely to produce fertile ground for religious trauma, or even trauma in general, and others less so. And being aware of those structural elements can be very, very helpful, both in learning to understand things that we might have experienced personally, or people that we know and care about might have experienced, or just things to be cautious of, to be attenuated to. Because this is a series, I want to do a quick review of part one. It might be helpful. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but just a little bit. Last week I said that what we're exploring in general is something that we could call religious trauma. There's a technical term that extends from that, religious trauma syndrome, that we'll talk about at some point. We considered that just based on that language of religious trauma, we're talking about the intersection of two pretty big categories, religion and trauma, and I sort of illustrated the complexity of some of these intersections with this picture of this complex highway interchange. Last week, we started into the religion side of things with some initial exploration of what branch of the Christian religion we were talking about and how we were defining our terms. I'm not going to recap all of that. It's in the podcast. If you need to recap it, you can find it on our website, thetablewinnipeg.com, under the podcast tab. One of the people that I've been reading in my research for this series says that they want to believe, the author says they want to believe that in many ways, the impact of the institution of evangelicalism, as we defined it last week, is unknown. So listen to this. This is their opinion. Is unknown even to itself. And that if those with the greatest influence within the institution truly knew about that impact, they would want to shift away from beliefs that harm and toward beliefs that heal. If there is such a thing as mixed hope, then that's what I would personally have about that opinion. I feel as though over my own years in and around some of these structures, I've met folks who I believe would tilt that way. And I've met others for whom this structure is about things like institutional preservation or self-securing or towing the theological party line or even just not being willing or able to face the discomfort of challenging it to such a degree that justification for and perpetuation of harmful teachings would prevail. I think it's a mixed bag. I've personally had people seek me out years after harmful actions or interactions to tell me how they've changed their perspectives and to ask for my forgiveness. Now, the asking of forgiveness part has usually struck me as a bit curious and most often unnecessary, and this is not a statement of virtue for me. It's because I think the problem is systemic. But in some instances, it's also been really important for people to know that I don't hold their actions against them. And not the least of the reasons for that is because of how often their explanation for their actions, which I choose to take that explanation at face value whenever and to whatever degree I can, is something along the lines of, I thought I was doing what was right because I was doing what I was taught or what my leaders told me to do. When I have ended up having these conversations with people, it's almost always been because they have been able to stand back from what happened and see it from a perspective other than the one that they were taught, to see it differently, to see the same events in a different light. And that's why I would say it's systemic. And also, when they saw it differently, they acted differently and sought to make amends. Also, there is a potential link here to trauma for some of these folks in my personal experience, which I think we'll see more clearly when we get to that part of the exploration, which we won't get to today. Because today what I want to do is expand a bit more on the religion entry point. So last week I summarized some of the core beliefs of evangelicalism this way. I noted the belief in the historical accuracy and literal interpretation of both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. I was taught that this level of inspiration was, and this is the technical language, verbal and plenary. Some of you recognize that language. Those are just fancy words for fully and completely. That's what those two words actually mean. But the upshot of this theological position is the belief that every single word, this does include punctuation, by the way, does include punctuation, every single word in the original manuscripts was divinely breathed out by God, and that includes doctrine, history, geography, names, while also preserving the distinct personalities and writing styles of the human authors. Just a little detour here. How many of you have ever played the telephone game? You know that one where somebody at the beginning of the line has a sentence and they say it to the person that's next and they say it to, and then the person at the end says their sentence and they compare it to the first sentence? Right. So the gymnastics that I have sat through of people trying to explain how documents, not to mention document fragments, not to mention original documents that no longer exist, could be transmitted over thousands of years through cultural shifts, through different emphases in translation, and still be precise and authoritative, it boggles my mind when I think back on it. And for whatever reason or reasons, even as an undergrad, I was like, I don't think that's believable to me. And that is without critically examining the original idea itself, which is that something could be divinely brought into the world by a human author, retaining both their author's uniqueness and its accuracy as verbal and plenary. Unless humans have fundamentally changed in some way over the intervening years, I don't think I know a single author who would find that idea ultimately believable. Either you have a mechanic writing down what is breathed, or you have an author who has a perspective. And that perspective, if it's human, is limited, because humans are limited. Like, you can't, I don't see how you can make those two things swim in the water together. But I've heard lots of erudite, well-educated people work hard to do just that. In any case, so that's my perspective. You don't need to share it. But I don't want you to be ignorant of it, because it informs all of this. In any case, for our purposes, it's also of particular note that this belief structure includes the divinity, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Christ, and it includes the belief in the necessity of personal conversion, of being born again as a condition for salvation. So that's all part of that same structure, right, when it comes to evangelical Christianity. And the underpinning of that belief is the notion that conversion and salvation are necessary because of what are we being saved from? Because of the existence of a place of eternal conscious torment called hell that all people in their natural state are deserving of because they have been born into a nature of inherited sin. So that's the structural, theological structure of all of that. Now, that last one bears a bit of further examination. It's worth remembering that we're exploring this as adults. But when you grow up in these systems, you are taught these things as children. Fundamentally different equation, all right? When you are indoctrinated as a child to believe in phenomena like the rapture, for example, as a literal event in which all true believers vanish from the earth in a moment, everyone else is left behind to sort out the chaos, or you're taught as a child in the value of redemptive violence, the ultimate example of which is God killing his own kid to save us, or in the existence of a place of eternal torment after death, a place where you're headed because of your inherited and unavoidable state of sin, or about the impurity of the female body, Eve started all this, remember, or the impossibility of achieving God's love without surrendering to all the belief system's beliefs. Well, to put it mildly, that's a lot, and it paints the holder of those beliefs into some rather terrible corners. Now, some of those beliefs contradict themselves. I'm not going to get into that, except to observe that lots of parents who are teaching their kids these things really may not be doing so methodically. They might be doing it imitatively, or because it's what they were taught and know, or because their authority figures say so, or they might just be handing that part of their kid's formation over to someone else, someone who's authorized to do it. It remains remarkable to me, like just logically remarkable, that in many of these structures, which are patriarchal as well, because literal reading of the text, that the women are trusted with this, but not with preaching. Think it through, people. Like, if you're really trying to protect your community from being misinformed, you're going to withhold the ultimate authorities from the most readily formed parts of your community? Like, that's not even logical. But anyway, pet peeve. In my personal story, one connecting point that I can clearly recall, and there's lots of examples, but this one has stuck with me, is that as late as late grade school, even early adolescence, I would wake up in the night in a quiet house, and I would feel deeply afraid that the rapture had come and I had been left behind. But I felt confident that my parents, whom I believed were good, saved in the language that I'd been taught, yet believed that if they were still there, then the rapture hadn't happened yet, because if it did, they'd be gone, that the rapture was still waiting in the wings. And so I would get out of bed, middle of the night, I would tiptoe down the hall to their bedroom door, and I would listen for their breathing. And if I could hear them, I would go back to bed reassured that for the moment at least, I had not been abandoned. Or to put it another way, God had not taken my parents away from me. Because that's what this idea means. Now, when I wrote that, my heart rate changed. I've studied this. I know how this works. Cognitively, I can get my head around it, and I have spent years examining this, both in the systems that perpetuate it and in my own psyche. I now know that what I was experiencing in those moments was a muted, and I'm grateful for the things around me that muted this, but I was experiencing a muted version of a very specific form of fear known as rapture anxiety. That's a thing. I probably shouldn't logically be surprised at the strong feelings that still accompany some of these memories, at the emotional recall of it, but that's not the way trauma works, as we will consider in due course. The bump isn't as big, but it's still a bump. Reconsidering or leaving these kinds of narratives isn't simple stuff, even if saying, I no longer believe thing X comes quickly. Sometimes I feel like it's a little bit, the process is a little bit like shouting into a canyon. The echoes don't disappear after one reflection, but they can fade over time. At least that's a possibility. That whole where will you end up forever piece is also one of the key doctrines that I think bears a little more examination in the context of this exploration. The evangelical salvation narrative, I would call it explainer story, basically begins with the doctrine of original sin. That's where it starts. The belief that stems from a literal reading of the Genesis poems is teaching that Adam and Eve chose knowledge over God, right? So that's basically the choice that a literal reading of those poems brings you to. And in that storyline, to disobey God is to sin, and God's disappointment then condemns all those born of Adam and Eve, the whole human race, to be born as sinners. That's how that doctrine rolls out. So, for our human parents, Adam and Eve, to stray from God and enact their own will by choosing their own desires, that separated all people from God's presence and permanently altered the state of the world and also permanently corrupted humanity, which also permanently doomed both our bodies and our souls. Hence, the conscious part of eternal conscious torment. If we know this, we're conscious of it. And in this narrative, Separation from God is a human choice. Also embedded in this narrative, because salvation is available, right? Also embedded in this narrative is the assumption that we arrive in the world as humans with a built-in urge to rebel against goodness and morality, and that this state, our depraved nature, to use the technical term, leaves us in desperate need of rescuing from divine wrath. Let's think about the implications of this for a moment. Everything that makes us human, our bodies, our flesh, is in this story instinctively bent toward disobedience and evil. I'm not saying I chose my words perfectly, but I can tell you that I chose them with care. Think about instinct for a moment. When those geese start flying in the fall, and I'm looking around and going, it's 30 degrees, what do you know that I don't know? They're not choosing. That's instinct. So in this theological construct, our instinct, the thing that we are bent toward in such a way that it moves us to action, is toward disobedience and evil. That's the starting point. In that structure, we can't save ourselves, and we can't trust ourselves. I felt like when I wrote that sentence, I felt like, Tim, maybe what you need to do this week is you need to sit down on your stool in front of this group of people who extend you so much trust, and you just need to say over and over again for half an hour, in this system, we can't save ourselves, and we can't trust ourselves. We can't trust ourselves. We can't trust ourselves. Because the implications of that are staggering. If we hold beliefs like this, it also makes it hard for us to develop positive feelings toward those who don't share these beliefs. Because their failure to believe, remember, belief is what redeems us, makes them unworthy of compassion or empathy. It's an available choice. If they don't choose it, they're not worthy. Right? What's left in that structure is to offer those perceived as others, those who don't make that choice, to offer them some kind of like an imperious, infantilizing sympathy. And if we focus that lens in the other direction, it can make it really hard to extend compassion and empathy toward ourselves. don't participate in answer to this question, but the question that comes to mind is, how many times have some of you been saved? Like, how many times have you prayed that prayer? How many times have you confessed it? That just, I got to get this right, because if I get it wrong, eternal conscious torment. Like, it's an all-or-nothing game. That difficulty with extending compassion and empathy toward ourselves can, in pretty short order, especially for a child, lead to the narrative that self-esteem is evil. If the self is inherently corrupt, and you regard the self highly, you esteem the self, you are esteeming what is evil. Like, that's the loop. Right there, in one sentence. I've joked in this space about my mom saying that we should be careful not to sprain our arm patting ourselves on the back. That's sort of this gentler version of these same ideas. Like, that's how this ripple goes out. And from inside the system, it makes sense, doesn't it? Like, if our true self, if our flesh was so corrupt that it couldn't be believed or supported on its own, because that's what that means, then regardless of what our intentions could be, our motivations and impulses and those of others had to be regarded as impure and capable of being taken over or mobilized by unseen cosmic forces of evil. Like, those are the implications, right? So if you were here last week, you might remember me introducing this series with that aerial photograph of this complicated traffic interchange. And I made the observation that as a photo, it might look pretty lovely, and someone in the group interjected, but not if you're driving on it, which was exactly the observation I was going to make next. I love when that happens. The point was that even something that might look intriguing at a distance can feel like a trap when we're in it and we can't get out of it. And being taught that the way to understand the divine as good is by understanding ourselves as evil is a bit like that. That's a loop that you can't get out of. Now, I want to invite us to do something that might be helpful. It might also be really difficult. It might not be available to you to do. It might not be a good choice for you to do this. I can't judge that for anyone. I offer it with care. and invite you to step away internally or externally or as you need. But what I want to invite you to do is to think about this as much as you're able from a child's perspective. Think like a child. You are taught, child, that your innate, pure self-esteem, one of the gifts children arrive in the world with, is not only suspect, but it's actually evil. And because your sin nature is inescapable, there needs to be some kind of antidote to that, or you're doomed. What might that antidote be, and where might it come from? It can't come from humanity, because we're corrupt. So it has to come from God. So out of this emerge various theories of atonement. There's ransom theory, there's Christus victory theory, there's moral influence theory, there's scapegoat theory, etc. The one that gets traction in evangelicalism is called penal substitutionary atonement. And in short, this is a notion that Jesus was punished by his Father, crucified to be specific by human agents, on behalf of all human sinners whom God could not abide. And at the center of this theory is the notion that the divine has a thirst for punishment because of his anger towards sin and his need for justice. Remember, you're learning this as a child. And in this view, it's the death of Jesus, more than his teachings, life or even resurrection, that is most important. What's at the front of the church? It's a cross. From that perspective, what might be the implications of an innocent Jesus needing to suffer and die to atone for a child's inescapably wicked self and to save that child from God's justifiable wrath? And if you grew up around this, I don't need to remind you that this narrative is conveyed as good news. That's what the word gospel literally means. Good news, or to proclaim the good news. Kids, this is the gospel. Maybe it'll help, maybe it won't. But maybe it'll help if I put this out there as some questions a child might have in light of this narrative, if they were encouraged to question it. If God needed to kill his son to save me because I was so awful, was I lovable in the first place? And even if I was lovable, was it only because of the fact that Jesus did something for me, that I was, to use the language of the system, covered by his blood? Why did someone else's blood, children are pretty literal, folks, stay with me, why did someone else's blood have to be spilled for me to be lovable? And if that is true, what does that mean for all the people who don't recognize that blood as the only thing that somehow cleaned them up and made them lovable too? Does that mean they're unlovable? Does that mean that we're on opposite teams? Does that make me right and them wrong? Does it mean that now I'm pleasing in God's sight and they are not? Does that mean that they can be lovable to me or by me, even if they're not lovable to God? Just take a moment to imagine that set of questions coursing through your child's psyche when you discover that your school bestie doesn't believe the gospel. That's a doozy, isn't it? I'm not making this set of questions up out of the blue. It is based on the reflections of people who grew up in these systems and who've made the journey of reflection and recovery. That list is not exhaustive. We haven't even touched on the dilemma of realizing that within this system of belief, even my own rightness isn't actually mine. It didn't grow from within me, but it came from outside of myself, and that was only because of a belief in sin nature in the first place that would make something like this substitution necessary. I can only be pardoned by acknowledging how bad I had been to begin with. There's no other path in. All right. At some point, this can start to feel like considering it as listening to something loud with no chance to turn down the volume and get a break from it. That might have happened for some of us a while ago. For others, it might feel like we're just getting started and we're frustrated about stopping at this point and everything in between, but we will pick it up again next week. Someone asked me this morning how long this series would be, and my answer was, I don't know. but we won't be utterly relentless with it. We will, if necessary, take a break from it and do other things. But we will pick it up again next week or in the coming weeks. But where I'm going to leave us today is with the lyrics from a Mumford & Sons tune. The writing credits on it are the whole band from their latest album, Rushmere. I've heard this song many times. I enjoy Mumford & Sons musically. I've appreciated some of the ideological complexity, Mumford's own journey. I've always been fascinated by the way so much of their songwriting is informed with Christian imagery, but also kind of springboards off of that in ways that are sometimes a joyful surprise, other times leave me going, what was that? I've heard this song lots of times, but when I listened to it earlier this week, it sort of felt like a penny dropped. And I don't live inside these songwriters' heads. I can't tell you about their intentions as songwriters for this, but for me, this song is about what we've been exploring today. And you be the judge. I won't play it for us. I'm just going to read us the lyrics. And you can listen to it. The song is called Carry On, last song on the album. So this is how they leave this is how they leave the conversation of the album. If this is what it's like to be unholy, man, if this is what it's like to be lost, I will take this heresy over your hypocrisy and count any cost. If this is what it's like to be empty again, if this is what it's like to be adrift, I will take this darkness over any light you cast, you and all your original sin. Carry on, carry on. Because there's no evil in a child's eyes. Carry on. There is still a stillness over the deep. There is still a word in the night. The day-blind stars over our head again wait with their light. Carry on, because there's no evil in a child's eyes. Carry on, because there's no evil in a child's eyes. It was made and it was good. Carry on. In this context, I think it's fair to say that we call that carrying on exploring what you believe. Carry on. Peace.